Okay. Good evening, everyone. Welcome. Hi. I'm Katya, and I'm hosting this series of research symposium. And wow, as I look around, there's a lot of you here from many places in the world. You know, Susan, you just returned to town. Welcome. And many of you are participating in the MACFA 3, right now, residency. And also, I know, local people, and it's nice to see so many faces. We're here tonight with Amici. Thank you, Amici, for doing this. And she will be speaking on trauma and deep democracy. And I know, Amici, you're going to speak also about what draws you to this work in your own experience. But I want to say personally that I'm honored to have you here, and I feel there's something very special around the wisdom that you bring to this work. Because I know that you bring your personal life experience dealing with and surviving trauma. And I don't think that that's the language you will use, but I think you're going to talk more about that. And also, I know that you've worked extensively with people who have been through many different kinds of trauma, including sexual abuse, addiction work. And so I feel that you're able to speak to so many different roles and experiences, that you're very connected, you're deeply connected to this topic. So thank you. And I'll let you.
I have to give you a hug. That was such a nice introduction. Thanks. And also, I have a slightly covert agenda in the sense of having a hug. It helps me to, like, stay in my body. Because I'm feeling incredibly nervous. And I think, whoa, you too. Oh, good. I'm happy to share the role, believe me. And I think, oh, why am I nervous? I think because someone in me who says, "Oh, you're presenting, you should be really linear. It should be, you should start here and go in a fairly straight line and get to the end." And actually, that's not really my most organic style. But I'm going to try. And I welcome you to ask questions at any time, and that would be helpful to me, because I'm likely to zigzag, and also I want to invite you to use me as a resource. In the sense that I come here with two experiences. One, the experience of someone who went through a lot of trauma as a child, and then again in my early 20s, of a sexual nature. And then between the 20s and the mid to late-ish 50s, other kinds of trauma, like, you know, bike accidents, car accidents, skiing over a cliff, house fire, those sorts of things that, you know, no one is exempt from traumatic events happening. And, you know, as they say in the movies, sometimes bad things happen to good people and for no reason. Except in process work, it's like having a teleological approach. We think, oh, where is this going? What is this experience trying to bring into our lives? because, you know, as you probably know, when a person has a traumatic experience, they're overwhelmed and rendered helpless by forces that they cannot overcome or run away from. And so something gets caught in the moment of that experience, and something goes along in life. The question that I get concerned with when I'm working with people who are traumatized is partially to avoid the hypnosis of thinking that they have to tell everything that happened to them, and that equals healing. In some cases, for some people, that may be their prescription for their own healing and their own recovery, and it may make sense in their world. And so I honor that. But most often, it's the effect of the past trauma that it's having in the present moment that is the huge thing. And many people, a central issue is around dealing with the incredible range of overwhelming feelings. As the textbook says, to regulate your affects. And there's lots of techniques that you can do that, from taking all the parts of your experience, as we in this paradigm we would say all the figures, and interacting between them, finding the ghost. For some people, when a trauma memory comes up, the first thing that usually goes is language center. And sometimes to try to get a traumatized person to speak about the experience is trying to ask someone to learn to swim while they're drowning. So there's nonverbal ways of supporting a person to self-soothe themselves, regulate the affect. Something really simple like breathing, like just stopping and doing 1, 2, 3 on the in-breath, 1, 2, 3, hold it, 1, 2, 3 on the out-breath. It sounds really simple, but you think about things that you might do if you were working with a young person who doesn't have language up and formed yet, like an infant, approach in the same way, without being patronizing. That's a kind of a fine meta skill. And also teaching people ways that they can soothe their own body, certain acupressure points and things that you can teach them to keep the flow of chi throughout their body, which keeps the blood flowing, which keeps hopefully thoughts coming in. Mm-hmm. I think it's good if you use the microphone for questions.
As someone who may not, or actually doesn't, quite know this terminology,
mm-hmm.
Okay, so one, regulating affect. I don't quite understand. I mean, I understand what you're saying now about doing these things to calm yourself down, but something about, a little bit more about that would be helpful to me. And also when you say, people may not, it may not be the right thing to tell the whole story because it's how it's happening now in the moment that's important. Could you go a little bit more into that? Both those things.
Mm-hmm. When a person is traumatized, and we ask them to talk about it, or to say something about it, we are asking them to go back into a hell zone. And so, first of all, we have to be totally, pace that person's primary process very closely. Because there are certain, you're not ready to talk about something until you're ready, in a way. And also, there are some people I've worked with who just want to tell the story, because somewhere telling the story means equals healing, or that no one has ever believed them. So to have a space where someone wants to hear you and is totally present and believing is really huge. But then there are times when your thinking gets really triggered in a way that you cannot regulate your feelings. Think of yourself when you're really pushed and you're having a very strong emotions and thoughts going on. How do you calm yourself down? How do you get to a meta position? Just think of that in general life, and then imagine that it turned up 100 times, because depending on the age in which your trauma happened, if it happens before language, you have no defense to actually sort through what's happening. It just comes in without any filters. The capacity to marginalize unpleasant stuff is way less than it is when we're grown. So it's when you're overcome by emotion, utterly overcome, and you can't think your way out of it, and you're in the process of learning how to do that, learning to make sense and make meaning out of your feelings. And some of the earliest things that show up when folks are trying to learn to surf the river of intense emotions around trauma, three basic things show up. One is substance abuse. The second is disassociation. And the third is tension-reducing behaviours. And I'll just briefly go through this. Clearly, about substance abuse, it's an attempt to self-medicate. You use something on the outside to do it, something that you think will be quick. Because there isn't the capacity to hold the intensity of the emotion, because what I'm feeling now as a traumatized person when I'm re-triggered, I am back there when it happened. And I don't have the capacity, until I learn it, to realize this is going to come to an end. And part of the long process in recovery is being able to tolerate these intolerable feelings without, to have the feelings and know you're not being abused, for example. Do you know what I'm saying? That you can have a memory of being assaulted, at the same time know in this time, in this space, you are not being assaulted. That's a direction that we're trying to go in. Sometimes the terror of going back into those feelings, you just want to shut it down. So substances have an effect that way, have a use that way, but also, as we know from our addiction studies, that's a short way out of feeling awful feelings, but what looks like a short-term solution actually creates a problem. Because you, in taking a substance, you go and metaphorically stay the night in a hotel instead of learning to make your home here, now, in the present time. And then when the substance wears off, you're right back where you started. And then often with the attachment of a critical figure. The second way, early way of trying to regulate strong emotions that are overwhelming is to disassociate, to leave the body, to take on a new identity, that's not me, or to not remember. There's a whole lot of disassociative responses, and people are incredibly creative here. Leaving decreases your awareness of your pain, but again, like using a substance, the pain is still there, and it reduces your awareness of something that's still occurring. Mm-hmm. However, you don't have to have been traumatized to disassociate. It's something most of us do anyway. And sometimes it's really sensible. Every time I used to hear George Bush on the TV, I would disassociate. I think that's really smart.
When you say that, what do you mean, Amici? You hear George Bush, and what do you mean?
Suddenly, if it's daytime, that tree out the front yard looks really interesting to me. And I'm out there. Or I'm looking at the TV, but I'm daydreaming about what I might have for dinner. I'm not fully present. I'm not engaged. And a third very common tension-reducing way of dealing with strong affect is to do tension-reducing behaviors, which most of these are soothing, and they block guilt and self-hatred. Some of the common ways you'll see are cutting oneself. However, you know, with a chronic self-mutilator, the psychological pain hurts more than the physical pain. And I remember a young woman who used to do this, and it wasn't until I finally realized, well, she woke me up real quick, that until she saw the blood coming out of her body, she could not totally believe that she was in pain. She needed the visual cue to come back into her body. Another way is excessive sexual contact. Don't use the word promiscuous, because that's attached to a couple of subgroups that, if we're going to use promiscuous, use it for everybody. And really, there's having a lot of partners, but there's often not a lot of pleasure. It's trying to have a temporary, transient sense of power and no pain. Having no pain and feeling power are relatively non-sexual motives. Well, maybe not for everybody. And another way of tension-reducing behavior are eating disorders, particularly bulimia. Anorexia has not been shown to be associated with abuse, but I'm not sure I quite believe that. And also a lot of exercise, a lot of physical exercise is a good attention reducing behavior. It's not that people do this. It's the degree of avoidance that's the issue. You know, it's human nature to try to avoid something unpleasant. But if it becomes a lifestyle, then it's a problem. One moment, I think Kalpana had a question.
Michi, I want to go back a little bit. Mm-hmm. And you said that for the client, sometimes it is helpful to talk about it, and sometimes it is not helpful to talk about it. So as a therapist, you know, is there, when you have to sort of make the decision really quickly, maybe you don't have to make it quickly, but suppose you have to make a decision and your client is in front of you, what cues do you pick up? You know, you said observe the primary process, but are there any more cues about which way to go?
When I have to make the decision about?
When you're with the client, about whether to talk about it or to not talk about it.
Mm-hmm. That's a great and tricky question. For me, there's two underlying principles that I'm working with. And one is the empowerment process, and the other is connection. So, and I have the social rank of being in the helper role. So it's not my decision about whether this client talks about her or his trauma. It's my job to find out where they are in their process and to not, how do I put this? To be aware of their edges and to stay in edge city with them while supporting their primary intention. And it's really delicate because I can't help but think of the three-phase recovery. Like Judith Herman talks about the first phase of creating safety for the person, and that is a lot of things about you as a practitioner being reliable, and little big things like being on time, having a room, not changing the room, doing what you say you will do, and modelling, having a clear set of boundaries yourself. For example, in the early days, I used to say to people they could ring me up at home. Now that's okay in a certain time frame, for a certain period in a person's process, and also when there's crises. Because I'm not going to do for someone what they can do for themselves. That is inherently disempowering. If I decide it's time you talked about your trauma, then whose process am I following? But if you've come to my office for X amount of times and slid around focusing on something, I'm not doing my job if I don't gently bring the focus back to this. And sometimes there's a time to play out the part that wants to talk about it and the part that doesn't in front of the client and have them choreograph what happens next or direct or ask them, which side do you think needs the most support here? Anything you can to help them to climb into the position of having authority in their own recovery process. And the second phase is around reconstructing the story of what happened. Because, you know, a lot of the memories are like what they call lighthouse memories. You have vicariously strong memories, like someone comes into a dark room and turns a little torch on here, then there's a little torch on over here, another one over here. Helping to join the dots is really important. Trauma messes with your linear capacities. It messes with your capacity to make sense of things in a straight way, in a straight line. And you won't get a person's story starting at point A and going A, B, C, D, E all the way through. You're going to get A and then jump to E and back to B and then down to Z. And so often they feel at the mercy of this. And so our job is to help them to make sense of that narrative. And then the third stage, this is extremely briefly, and please look at Judith Herman's work for deeper stuff around this. And then the third phase, she talks about reconnecting back into relationship, into society, from in a process-oriented way, trying to put these two paradigms together. But the first stage is about the person's experiences, their primary process, what they experienced, and that whole story, and what they did to get through it. By nature, trauma survivors have resilience, a lot more resilience than we often recognize. And gently feeding back to them, reflecting back to them, moments where they've been resilient and being powerful, without making too much of a deal of it. If you make too much of a deal of it, in a way you take that experience from them. It's very delicate. And then phase two is more around the business of picking up the other. And that is usually the most unattractive role in the field. You know, a person who's been traumatized in one paradigm wants to put the traumatizer in a kind of prison and leave them there. And yet, from a deeply democratic viewpoint, when we do that, we're imprisoning a part of ourselves too. Even though it's a secondary part that we might not want anything to do with. We know from role theory that any role that is marginalized and cast out of relationship by being ignored or imprisoned in some box, whether that's psychic to physical, becomes a ghost, and a ghost that is over time dismissed and looked down on becomes a very hungry ghost. And hungry ghosts have sharp teeth. And they'll come out unconsciously through our signals. This won't be news to you. If you remember a person who identifies as being a victim or a survivor of trauma, and they're talking, and you have some interaction with them, and on the surface there's the experience of being victimized and surviving, and underneath there's a more secondary experience often that has a similar energetic quality to that of the perpetrator or the abuser. And that is a very tricky moment to engage with your client, and absolutely necessary. But it's inhuman to even attempt to do it until the first stage of creating safety, which means the person has some sense of there's someone reliable in the universe, they have their own safety network going for them, they have a sense of agency in life. Yes, I can get up in the morning, I can feed myself. Yes, I have a job. Yes, I'm managing money. Yes, this, yes. Back survival skills. And internally, well, yes, I actually lived through that. I did this to try. This is what I tried to do. This is what I can give myself credit for. It's only when you have developed a good therapeutic relationship with your client that you can even begin the tricky business of getting them to have some relationship with the secondary energy of the perpetrator or traumatizer. And it's very strong energy. And any of us, any of you who don't identify as having been traumatized, to identify with something secondary that's not attractive, that's a bit of work. And then when that secondary thing is something that was responsible for. You're asking. Absolutely. Yep. The theory fits across the board, but how you apply the theory is the difference, a real difference. But that's the part of this work that I'm really fascinated with right now, because I find it tricky and I find it attractive. And I have a high dream of not wanting people who have been traumatized to have to, in a sense, work as long and wait as long as I had to even begin to see that there was any value in picking up a homeopathic dose of the energy of the other side. Over here.
Just so people know, we're trying to use the mics because it's being recorded and there are a lot of people interested who can't be here. So.
Thanks. Sorry. I feel like it's a really huge thing you're saying.
Yep.
What's my question about it? I think it's something like, I don't know, I think I just want you to say more about it, like, maybe if you could say what helped you personally to be able to do that, pick up the other side. And something like just to conceptualize that the perpetrator or the abuser or the whatever the energy is on the other side, the killer, is somehow part of you, or that you should pick it up. In a way, sounds almost like abuse or something. You know
right.
what I mean?
Yeah, I do.
So, how do you not become that in the moment when you try to get someone to pick that up or
mm-hmm.
anything along those lines?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's like I kind of try to do it in a zigzag way. Let me answer the first part first. What helped me was a whole lot of negative feedback, in the sense that I was unconscious of how much I went after a certain group. I talked about, I mentioned this a little bit in class today. I was sexually abused and my abusers were male people. And I did, you know, some immediate sort of recovery work, safety, told my story, was believed, et cetera, et cetera. That was the end of the therapy at that time. But I was walking around with a whole lot of rage, a lot of revenge, a lot of destructive energy. I was trouble looking for somewhere to land. And where did I land? I landed on men. I landed on men everywhere, in the street, in my personal life, in my neighborhood. A man just had to look at me in the wrong way and I'm like, what are you looking at? And with the same kind of energy that had no for personal boundaries, no back loop, and just an intention to create hurt on the side. And it wasn't until, you know, I got a lot of feedback and I realized it was a close male friend who said to me one day, God, you remind me of my Uncle George, and he was a real prick. And I thought, ooh. You know, as a radical lesbian feminist at the time, to be called like I'm Uncle George, that woke me up. You know? And then it's thinking, oh, you know, it's like, draw a parallel with the classical social activists. I had this on my side and I had ideology. And I was, they were wrong. And so I had all this energy floating around in the universe looking for somewhere to land. I was that energy was a hungry ghost looking for a home. And the home that it needed was relationship, real relationship, not people scattering from me and not people necessarily meeting fire with fire. So when I am with a friend or a client or anybody really, who has some kind of abusive or trauma in their life, and there's that little bit, sort of a little bit of a kick coming out, I go, ooh, ouch. I have the reaction. And so they can see that they're having an impact. And then, very gently, I'll inquire, did you see the effect you had on me? When you do this, do you know that the impact is this? Because people don't. People don't. If you're identified with being victimized, you don't see when you're a victimizer. If you're, it's the same, you know, if you're identified as being an oppressed person, you're not so clear about where you're oppressive. And we are all traumatizers, and we are all traumatized. We're all oppressors and we're all oppressed. In the sense of, it's part of the rainbow of our personalities. And sometimes we're more identified and more attached with one experience at a time in our life. But the potential for all of them is, and that is actually a factor of deep democracy. Because deep democracy, theory is fabulous, but actually living it and working it is hard work. Because we all have socialized identities. And it's not so much about getting rid of the trauma, but unfreezing that state and making it flow. Because the third stage from a process-oriented viewpoint of recovery is A, you know your experience of being victimized. B, you know the experience and the capacity you have to be a victimizer. And then the third stage is about the fluid backwards and forwards, the fluid zigzagging between those two poles of experience. It's not about trying to obliterate trauma or make war on trauma. It's about processing it. Does that explain it enough? Because it was such a lot in that question, I have to double check. Oh, and also the other thing that woke me up was an honest of loneliness in the relationship channel. Is that, yeah, I can blast people out of the water, but I couldn't be vulnerable.
You couldn't be what?
Vulnerable. Vulnerable equals being weakness. Weakness equals being susceptible to abuse. So that whole experience was marginalized out of my field of potential experiences. And these, I think it's really powerful when a person can say, yeah, I'm strong and I'm vulnerable too, and have both of those things. They aren't necessarily happening at the same time, but, you know, why fix a person into one local experience they're having now? We're much more complicated than that. So deep democracy, supporting having all the parts of our experience, especially the ones that are ugly and unpleasant. However, it's enough. That's a question of timing. If you jump start, if you think, oh, okay, this person now seems really, you know, safe enough and relatively sane, and they can put things together and look at this power they have, and they're aware of where their personal swamps are, that they fall into unconsciousness. Oh, now it's time for them to work on their secondary issues. With the question that Kalpan brought up, that is not my decision as the helper. It is a co-decision. We co-create this together. And yet, if Kalpan was my client and she gave me some kind of dig in the ribs, some kind of critical something or other, in the very earliest stages, I would just file it away. And later on, knowing it'll come back again, I would have an ouchie. And I would, like I said before, my hurt. And then I would try to unfold that experience with her, because it's not in the forefront of her awareness. But it's something that we, and I, if I'm getting negative feedback to that, knock three times and leave it alone and file it again for another point, knowing it'll come back. Someone wrote and asked me a really wonderful question about, given that process work is a feedback-based system, is there a time that it's ever contraindicated to use process work? And the concern was that, if you go in too far too soon and try, and you have an agenda to get the person to talk about their story, and they don't have enough self-support systems going on internally, that you can provoke some kind of flashback or backlash later. So to that I'd say, yes, process work, feedback and signal awareness is a neutral tool, but like any tool, it's only as good as the use to which it's put. And it's a fundamental question of timing. I can't guarantee that when a person leaves my office, they're not going to have some kind of inner backlash, because it's usually extremely everyday things that might trigger. It might not be the content of the session. I try not to go any further than what they call in textbooks the therapeutic window. What can the person tolerate in the moment? And if you overshoot it, you take them further than they can deal with. How do you know? Very, very, very close attention to details. Going slow, checking it out. If you undershoot it, if there's a right moment and you don't step in and use it, the person will feel that, you know, you're like Auntie Mary holding their hand. That might be why they come to therapy for a period of time. I'm sorry, Auntie Mary. I didn't mean to put her down, but that, you know, you're like a tea cozy friend. That's very nice and cozy, and that is good. And we need to do more. So it's really a question of timing. And I want to say that any tool that we use is only as good as the person using it in the moment. One of the disadvantages of the process work paradigm, from my view, is that it's quite dependent on the person that uses it. But then as someone close to me said earlier, aren't most therapy paradigms like that? Yes. So really it's about like feedback in the moment, totally noticing and checking it out. And if you're not sure, do less.
Michi, I have a question. This is thank you for doing this. This is really stirring up a lot of thoughts, and it's very valuable. And it's also a little bit difficult to kind of be engaging with this. I'm getting kind of like excited and a little bit like scared, and just a lot of stuff going on in my body. And maybe other people are having that experience too. But
I am.
So I'm trying to remember all the things that I know to take care of myself. But I have a question, and I'm a little bit nervous speaking, so I'll try and explain it. There's something about the way in which process work, there's a way in which seeing someone as traumatized or seeing someone as a trauma survivor or having trauma is kind of in a way borrowing from the medical model to some degree. It's a way of saying, okay, there's a person who has a problem. And I've found that framework extremely useful. I'm by no means unwilling to use that kind of medical model when it's useful. But my question is that if you see someone as traumatized or they're at a certain stage in the recovery ladder, or you see yourself as traumatized and at a certain stage, is there a way in which you lose a sense of the person's wholeness and you start to see them as like, I'm higher than you because I'm more healed, and you're still at this lower stage where you can't pick up your secondary process, or you can't remember and tell the story in a coherent way? And doesn't it start to lose the unity of this, of yourself and other? And especially when I'm thinking about people that I know in my life, I'm thinking about people in my family, people I've met, people I've been close to, who have just dealt with such heavy, heavy trauma that there are parts that are just locked away, and I would love for them to get support and be able to move through stages, but I don't think that they're going to, and I don't think that's going to happen. And further, maybe it's not right for me to say that it should, that their wholeness is dependent on them recovering something that I think that they're missing or going through some kind of healing stages. So I guess, do you kind of get the question I'm asking? Something about how do we see the other or ourself, if we're traumatized, as not less than, not more broken, not less whole than those of us who maybe are free or who are healed from trauma.
I love what you're saying. Right. If you fix a person to their trauma experience, you know, it's like taking a butterfly and pinning it to the wall, and you stop it flying. You freeze frame that person around an identity of trauma, and you marginalize all the other things that they are. And I radically disagree with the state-oriented view that once you've been traumatized, you're always going to be a trauma victim. And inside that role of being on the receiving end of trauma is a whole continuum of experiences. For example, from my viewpoint, yes, I was a victim of sexual abuse, and I survived it, and in some ways I'm thriving from it. And in one day, I can have any one of those experiences. Things were done to me that I had no control over. I have a toolkit. I have a bunch of survival skills that I've learnt over the years, and something in me thrives. I should try and explain that a little bit more. It's like seeing, yes, trauma is an awful, overwhelming experience that happens to you from one viewpoint. From a dreaming viewpoint, you could say also, that is a fast line to your fate on this planet. This is a fast line to finding out what gifts that you have on the other side of this awful thing that's happened to you. For example, I have a psychological rank that nobody can ever take from me now, built from surviving things that have taken other people out of this world in one way or another. I think people like you, not you, but people like you're mentioning, who haven't had some of the opportunities that I have, or who checked out through addiction or suicide or accidents. And so that's one of the reasons why I'm willing to be public about this. Plus, you know, the Tao gave me this shitty experience for some reason. It must be meant to be in service to something greater than my life. There's a meaning to it. And I attach that to my myth. And like, it's very helpful to make sense of what's happened to you if you look at your childhood myth. Your life myth. And your childhood dream is the first door into that. So we're born to do something in this walk, in this time in life. And sometimes you find out what that is through, you know, awful things that happen to you. Also on the other side, I'll say a little more. I have now a bodily integrity that I totally trust. One of my concerns in working in this whole area of trauma is that we often leave out the body, and the body is really smart. Peter Levine's work about working with the body and learning from how, fundamentally studying how animals deal with trauma, they're under threat and they survive the threat. Their body automatically starts to discharge that energy, pretty much the way that young kids do, pretty much the way we did before we got socialized to be pretty and nice and all of that, and strong and keep it all in. And there's an instinctive intelligence that's embedded in our cells. And so getting back to that and doing a lot of work on the body, it's like my body is so much smarter than my mind. And sometimes my mind has to catch up to my body. So learning to trust those sensory grounded experiences are really important. And learning to track what happens in your body and make sense of it with your mind is really important. I don't know if I would have been able to... I don't know. I can't say because stuff happened. And also knowing certain triggers... What triggers you are often very ordinary, everyday things. There's a certain song that I don't want to hear again, and I haven't heard it for at least 10 years, so I don't know how that would trigger me. Going to the dentist. I have built a relationship with my dentist where now if I wave my hand like that, that means stop immediately, because having to have my mouth open for longer periods than I would choose to is provocative for my body and my mind. So, and I don't want them to like process anything with me. I simply want them to give me space so that I can self-soothe, so that I can regulate my affect, as the textbook says, and take back a sense of my own sovereignty. Now, people go through this all the time. If you're in a lift, the next time you're in a lift and you see a man or a woman going pale and sweating, you might want to think to yourself, this could be someone who was imprisoned or tortured, being enclosed, or someone who was mistreated as a child by being locked in a cupboard or something. All kinds of things. We don't know why this person is having this experience, but it's good to start to think, well, what could be happening here? On the other side too, it's true. You take the perpetrator. This is not a one-dimensional experience. Inside that role, there are lots of different experiences. For example, we just look at sexual abuse. Many sexual abusers were themselves abused as children. So there's at least an experience of being rendered powerless. And then on top of that, with some of the rigid sex role conditioning, it's tough for men to have an experience of feeling powerless, especially physiologically. And it's got associations with, I'm being overpowered. I must be like a woman or like a womanly man or something. And you can see misogyny and homophobia in there. And yet, so there's the powerlessness, and then coming with that, there's a need for revenge. And then having that revenge and feeling the power of having impact on someone, people get drunk on it, and that power becomes an addiction. But with their behavior, what is the perpetrator trying to tell us, actually? We know what they're doing, but what is the inside story in this person's life? I think when I've had very little experience of working with male sexual perpetrators, but some. And one thing was really common. All of them had been sexually overpowered and invaded when they were children. All of them were men who felt really powerless in their lives. And all of them blamed the young victim, because see that young victim as an unformed adult. They saw that person, that young girl and often also a young boy, being provocative. They applied adult standards onto children's behavior. So there's some screw up there in their understanding of what's young and what's old, to put it. So now it's like, it's very easy and very tempting and quite lazy to decide that the perpetrator is just a one-state experience, so therefore lock them up, shoot them, get rid of them. But it's much more complicated than that, and we can't afford to do that. I mean, I ask myself, why is it that there's so much increasing trauma in the world? Why is it that we haven't somehow as a race got it together more? And I think part of the problem here is that we disavow the abuser. They're the baddie, and we freeze them. And actually, they need a lot of help.
People know that they want to work on like a horrible experience, or not knowing that ahead of time?
Both pop up because, you know, sometimes you're working on any topic and you it's like a thread and you pull it and out pops a whole lot of other things. So the answer to that is both. People come specifically to work on their trauma, and others, it's like it pops up out of an access memory. Mm-hmm. Let me say a little something about. Just to complete, Will, I think we have to remember some of the fundamentals of having. a process-oriented view is about going with flow, as different from a state-oriented view, which is fixing a person's experience into a box and giving it a label, and then fixing that person's identity around that. I am wary, very wary, in both senses of the word, of framing someone's experience only with one label, because it doesn't reflect the totality of who they are. And also, at the same time, someone can make a lifestyle out of being, you know, I'm a trauma survivor. I can make a lifestyle out of that. And I don't go against that in a direct way. What I do is highlight other things in their life as well. Because there's a reason why a person often says, well, yeah, I'm a trauma survivor. And it's like, I'm going to honor their primary process. I'm going to affirm that. And in my heart of hearts, I know that's not all of who they are. Okay.
Thank you, that's helpful.
Okay. Let me say a couple of things about us as practitioners. It's really important that we have and are developing a working knowledge of our own ranks, not just the social and global ranks that we have, but our psychological and spiritual rank. Because the more access you have to your inner experience, and the more of a multidimensional relationship you have to it, the less likely you are to get frozen when you have someone in your office who has a radically different view of reality to you, or a very different communication style, or an affect that freaks you out. And know what freaks you out. If really angry people are more challenging than really sad people, then maybe there's a little wood to burn there around anger. If really needy people make you feel judgmental, then that's something for you to explore. Not that you have to be perfect, but that you have to have a working knowledge of your own capacities emotionally. Becoming emotionally educated is as important as being intellectually and socially educated, particularly in this area. Because the deep change happens, you know, on a physiological and an emotional level. It's really important, I think, or I shouldn't say that, as I don't want to sound state-oriented. It's useful to have something grounded in a spiritual grounding that isn't completely in consensus reality. Whether you're into God or the goddess or the great spirit or the big you or your process mind or whatever, something that is outside of the realm of everyday human interaction. Because if you have your center totally in consensus reality amongst us human beings as we're schlepping our stuff and working it out, you're likely to lose your balance and get burnt out sooner than if you have a part of you that's fixed out of it, that's centered out of it. And it also reduces the potential for being vicariously traumatized yourself. And that's something to look out for, because it's really easy, being relatively open-hearted people, to feel traumatized somewhat around witnessing and going through someone's trauma story with them. So in a way, having a center that's not located in the here and now is really smart. I always, when I'm working with someone in their early stages of their trauma, I always take a few moments to find, to do either some vector work or like, oh my God, I'm frightened today of this. No, I feel fine about this. And then find my, the final line or drop into my process mind. And I particularly love the process mind because it's quick, it's easy, and it's private. And you can find the deepest part in your body as you identify it today and then associate that to a physical place and shape shift and go there in your mind. You're in a light altered state and pick up the qualities of that place, the sound, the feeling, the movement, and the, in a sense, the essence of it. And then I'm more ready to deal with anything that's going to cross my path. So I bring that up as a way of building up your repertoire of spiritual rank. And the other thing is ourselves, all of us, to be working on our own abuse dynamics. You know, to know where you're likely to become one-sided or to be dreamt up or to do something for the client that they can actually do for themselves because you love them and they've had a hell of a hard time and you want to make it easier for them. But actually, is that part of empowering them? And that whole thing about power, I can't empower any other person. Power is not a product that I have that I can give. What I can do is underline what I see that they're doing that's self-empowering or that's strong or that has meaning. But, it, you know, I can give people bread, but I can't give them power. But I can reflect back to them. And I can model power. I can model having power and I can model not having power and both being okay. Because again, empowerment is not a static thing. It's a powerful person who can also show his vulnerabilities. It's a powerful woman who can be both asking for her needs and also angry. They don't have to rule each other out. Another thing for the therapist is to keep a long view when working with trauma. If you think that this person having, you know, 10 or 17 sessions with you is going to be the end of their, they're going to be like healed and fixed up after that, forget it. Although it's such a crunch for many people working in the field in government agencies that, you know, there's evidence-based, you have to jump through this amount of hoops and you have to do amazing miracles within a finite amount of sessions. I don't think that's particularly helpful to have such a program. A program that I have is one that's co-created with the client. At the same time, I do have long-term goals, and my long-term goals are that they continually increase their awareness of themselves, the impact they have on other people and the world around them, and that they're constantly integrating new information. Right, and this thing about empowerment and connection are really huge. Okay, has anyone got any questions? I'm getting all... Nope. Okay.
I'm curious about the impact of what happens after a trauma in a person's life, a traumatic experience, or a big, overwhelming experience, and how that person is met or not, or if they have anybody to meet them at all after the experience, and that that is a community issue or a family issue. It's bigger than a family. That oftentimes people are isolated or they feel like there is no place to go besides maybe a therapy office if they can access that. I don't know if you would speak something to that. Like there's a bigger cultural or community issue around when people have big experiences. And I have this high dream that there's a way that, that communities can meet people and still love them and show them that they are whole and still pure, or still, you know, have, they're not isolated from the community. They're not suddenly have an aspect of them that doesn't fit in anywhere or something.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I share the same high dream. And why is it that when what happens to somebody, it's almost we support them, and yet somehow, like, get over it. You know, we support them, and yet there's this kind of foot tapping, kind of waiting for you to get back to normal again, as if normal is like this clean slate or whatever. And what is normal? You know, again, if it's really fixed, then it's a trap. And I think it's a sad reflection that when something traumatic happens, we don't automatically have a public meeting. Because you can't have a long-term traumatic issue happen to you without it also being a social problem. And yet, in particularly in Western societies, we privatize the bad things that happen and we really publicize the big things that happen, the good things, the so-called good things that happen. And that's screwy. Because if we took away good and bad and just said, this is a big thing that happened, let's approach it as a community. And we don't do that because this whole thing about privacy and the public-private split and also the body-mind split and, you know, the kind of the islands approach. I'm an island of experience myself, and you over there are an island of experience. But let's forget about the sea between us. And in a way, I'd like to see the approach where we actually go for the sea between us. If you're traumatized and I'm in the same community, then your trauma is part of my field. And so then I ask myself, what can I do to support this person to get what she or he needs in the moment? Whether it's, you know, take them home and put them to bed, or whether you help them, you know, with a hot water bottle and whatever, or find people what they for specific needs. But it's a disengagement that actually serves nobody except those who, except those that perpetrate, but it doesn't serve them either because they're still rendered in isolation. And it would be wonderful if we could bring together the abuser and the abused and anyone who was a bystander or a witness and process that. That is my high dream, that we would do that. That isn't what's happening, but it would be wonderful. And I think part of it is, I feel some motivation to break down those hard lines of privacy. You know, people, when I first used to talk about being an incest survivor, people go, "Ooh, you're amazing." And I'd think, "No." And then I'd think, "Oh, yes, I'm amazing." And now, yes or no, it's really not that relevant. It's like something happened. This was a secret and it was private. However, it's so common. But why aren't we talking about it publicly? It's an epidemic. And I'm just to jump way out in left field, I think that with the collective responsibility we have for mistreating the planet, the physical planet we have, and how now it is screaming in agony, overheating, major storms, droughts, fires, extreme. It's in an extreme state, our planet. We're heading towards an extreme state. That is going to, it is. It is already forcing us to start having public discourse about the abuse of the planet and find ways to deal with it. Is it going to take the threat of environmental extinction to bring us together as a species? I'm thinking on a really collective level, but it's the same thing as if you're talking about a sexual abuse that happened in the privacy of the family home. I see it as the same thing, just a different level. Why do we privilege the family as being a private institution? That's a problem I have. That was a great question, thank you.
What was my question? I don't know if I misunderstood an earlier answer, which could well be the case, but when you talk about your personal experience, Michi, and if it's inappropriate to talk, it's fine, but do you remember a period of sort of having it all bottled up? And then do you remember a moment or the coming together of many moments where suddenly you got language for your experiences, or you was, you know, what was that journey for you? I suppose that would be my question. Because earlier, I think I misunderstood an earlier answer that said you can't always sort of name trauma. You can't always point it out or name it. And
I understand you.
Yeah, and yet I see further suffering happening because someone isn't held in their trauma. It's like the chain seems to possibly never end. If that first person. Anyway,
right.
I don't know if I've asked a question.
I relate to people now. I assume that everyone has had some experience of being downed, whether it's like being just sort of lightly marginalized, to being abused, to being tortured, to being almost murdered or murdered, right? I relate to people as if you all are part of you is a history of abuse. I assume that everyone has experience of some kind of abuse. It's just a basic working thing that I have. I don't leave anyone out of that. That might be naughty, but that's my approach. And it's the degree, it's relative, it's the amount of the degree that you experience. And to answer your question on a personal level, I was so thoroughly conditioned from such an early age before language that I had no idea that what was being done to me wasn't normal. Can you believe it? At age 12, thereabouts, I overheard two girls in the toilet at school talking about some boys kissing them and putting their hands down their pants. And I had this incredible heat all through my body, and then I suddenly knew that what this father figure was doing to me was not normal. Even though the story of, I'm preparing you for marriage, for life later on, this is normal, you're my special girl, this is our special secret, and the payoffs that went with it, privileges of not being beaten like the other kids at that stage, little gifts, promises. It's like a whole house of cards came down in that one hearing that, and it was at that point, it was like a volcano was lit in me, and I started to fight back, and then things got really vicious, which ended in me finally running away from home. Had there been someone I even thought I could turn to in my family, looking outside the family was considered some kind of taboo. We were a poor family. We dealt with everything except those things that were pushed under the rug. What followed was quite some years of internalizing that oppression and developing a whole repertoire of dangerous sexual behaviors, challenging, like, crazy.
That's just so intense to hear.
Is that too intense for you?
Well, maybe.
I want to support you to take care of yourself then.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Does that mean I should stop? We're in this boat together, my friends. And there's nothing actually much more intense to say than that. That internalizing, you'll notice when you work with people how if there's no one to hold what you were saying before, that trauma, it goes internal. Often with females it goes internal. And it also goes external. A lot of risky behaviors, and also the creation, in my case, of intense drug addiction. Anything to not feel. And then to feel could only happen in situations of danger. So, and then, you know, it's a great pleasure to me in life these days to be normal, you know, to be able to have a range of experiences that fit between extremes and to be pleasurable. It's like you'll find this often with people whose boundaries have been really messed up early on, that they'll swing from one extreme to another, and it's finding the balance in the middle. Well, supporting the pendulum not to swing to such extremes, because what are you looking for when you're swinging for an extreme? You're trying to find some sort of internal balance that is all indigenous to you. And what will give me equilibrium might be really different from anyone else. Mm-hmm. There's a part of me that wants to say, I'm sorry if I was provoking people with the content. And there's another part that also wants to say, thank you for saying that, because this is the whole key. It's about the relationship. And I consider that a statement of self-care when people say, whoa, that's a bit provocative. Because there's one thing I've learned, that the effect I have on other people is real and tangible. And sometimes if I'm not awake with the effect I'm having in the moment, community, that's where the other, that's where you need to speak and say, hang on, that's too much. Or it would also be nice to say, hey, wait a minute, that's not enough. You know, so that it's more dynamic in the moment. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, when you hear me talk like this, notice in yourself whether you feel sorry for me. Or notice whether if you're putting me up on a pedestal. Right? Or notice if you're coming closer to me energetically or further away. And just notice that, because that's important.
That's an amazing comment you just made, Amici, about noticing ourselves, whether we're coming closer, moving away, putting you up, putting you down.
Mm-hmm. Yes, my experience does not exist in a vacuum.
Yeah, yeah.
And we also share a field together.
Yeah, and also you are sharing, so you impart and I absorb. And therefore I have a reaction, and it could be one of the four or maybe something else. But just to monitor ourselves when you say that is really important, I think.
Mm.
Also, I want to appreciate you sharing. Yeah, I just want to appreciate you sharing.
Mm-hmm. Well, I kind of, these days I start to think, the Tao that cannot be spoken, put this experience in my lap. In these days I think it's meant for more than me, I'm trying to make it useful somehow. But also the how is crucial. So that's where feedback is the greatest teacher. Feedback and my own process. Because sometime earlier, I would never have given any details like this. Partly because I've internalized shame. Partly because being role-bound and thinking, oh, a teacher, a therapist, a diplomat, you shouldn't be showing this personal side of you. And deeper than that, my freedom is really important to me, my freedom in the moment. And that freedom is contingent upon the effect it has on other people. So it's that dance again. At the same time, if I was talking about things of a personal nature and there was a role on the other side that said, no, I can't stand this, stop it. And that role stayed the same over time, I would have to address the stopping factor. Because that's also, again, about freedom. The freedom to not be stopped, the freedom to stop. They're all part of the same jigsaw puzzle. And essentially, it's all about relationship. Right. Any other questions people have? I can jump in a thousand different places here and just talk, but sure.
I have the luxury of working in one of those evidence-based practice organizations, and I'm wondering if there are some interventions that you would recommend, not necessarily that have to fit exactly within the evidence-based model or anything like that, but I guess process work interventions that would be basic and how to introduce working with people who are really unconscious of even having trauma, but it's there.
How would I work with people who are unconscious of having trauma?
Yeah, we're, for example, folks I work with have pretty big files, and you know in their file that, whoa, some serious stuff happened. Yet in conversation, they would never allude to it, and maybe it's something that should just never be brought up. I'm just wondering if there are some interventions that you'd recommend even kind of broaching the subject.
Well,
I don't know, kind of some trial and error stuff. Normally, if it's in the file, I don't mention it until they want to bring it up. But it kind of depends on the situation.
Right. It is hugely dependent on the context. When they come into your agency, does someone do an intake? Mm-hmm. That's often where you can ask questions, not necessarily the question of did someone sexually abuse you when you were younger, but like did anyone do something sexual to you when you were a child is a better question because it's more open. And we're not using the big A word. You know, people trip out often when they hear the word abuse, and that there's a whole range of experiences inside that word. So I would be, in the intake thing, I'd be asking general questions. Like, you know, what was your relationship like with your parents when you were a kid? If I suspect that maybe they were battered or neglected or it's in their file, well, they're coming on intake. And it's like little moments that pop up. It's like you use what actually is given rather than decide now is the day they're going to look at such and such. That's an abuse of our social rank in the situation. Unless people are there because they have to be and they have to work on it, and I hope for the practitioner I'd feel sympathy. You know, if you have to work with someone who has to work with you, then first of all you have to work with the having to work together, because otherwise it's going to blow up in your face. The ghost role that's making the practitioner and the client work together, that role has to be worked together first. Otherwise you're not going to be able to form a real relationship. What you say, your question actually reminds me of a situation I had with someone some time ago who identified as being a survivor of a particular sort of abuse and was very specific about what a bad therapist someone else was and said that person shouldn't work with trauma. And wanted me to do something about it. And I asked this person, you know, what's between her, what's stopping her talking to the person about it? And she had an answer to that, and we talked about it. And then basically, to make a long story short, she was using her trauma history as a form of expertise that said, I know what is right and I know what is wrong, in a way that was across the board. And I had to interrupt that. And I said, it's good that you know what you want for yourself. And very gently said something like, yeah, you know, those of us with a trauma history, we can actually have quite a bit of impact about getting our needs met. And she knew what I was talking about. She was like saying, look, I have this inside knowledge as a trauma survivor, and I know what is a good therapist and what is a bad therapist. And I'm not taking that away from her at all. But to go into the relationship channel, her edge was to actually be direct with the person, even with the offer to be an ally and just sit with her. So it was like using her trauma history basically as a soft weapon. So, but she wasn't conscious of it. And that's a complicated situation I'm bringing up also. But be mindful of that, because, you know, we're always kind of, in a sense, wheeling and dealing and trying to make our way through things. And often we're unconscious of some of the oomph, some of the clout we have. She was really not at all in touch with the power that she had to demolish that therapist's reputation. And it was highlighting how powerful she was, that, and then disagreeing with her. Yes, you're really powerful and you can be very clear about what you want, but you can't impose your standards of need across the board. Does that make sense? She was trying to make a one-size-fits-all approach. And actually, in that moment, it was really important to her to have power, and to have power over an identified authority and to be right. But to support her to then get drunk on that power is not healthy. It's a really fine line to support her power, but not to support her to then be reckless with it. Microphone.
I thought I heard you say that maybe she wasn't conscious of the power she had to ruin that therapist's reputation, and I wanted to suggest that maybe she was, and that's part of the secondary process you've been talking about, the vindictiveness, the anger of, you know, having that kind of power and control.
Mm-hmm. I don't think in the moment that she was aware of it, but she became aware, more aware of her power, and you may be right.
I'm only saying that because I've had that in my experience. Right. I've felt that way myself.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Mm-hmm. And you mean in the sense of like wanting to know you have impact?
Yes, or
wanting more, wanting revenge?
Yes, on a therapist.
Right.
Like knowing that, or being, you know, and being an expert as well, that kind of thing.
Right, right. It can be like an ace card to say, well, yeah, hey, I'm a trauma survivor. Don't challenge me. Unless you're another trauma survivor, don't even speak to me. It can be like an inside club for sure. And it's really good to talk about that. Thank you for bringing it up. Because unconscious revenge is that, and it's unconscious. The
yes.
Conscious revenge going for it is something else.
For in my experience, the unconscious part was that it wasn't furthering my own process. You know, it took me a while to realize that.
Right.
It was a
Me too. And I think that that is not particular to us abuse trauma survivors. I think it's a human thing. People, you know, if you've been hurt by someone that has more rank than you, and to the extent where you feel that there's nothing you can do or say to get it across to them to wake them up to how they're misusing their rank, or they're so freaked out and unaware of how they're doing it, so defensive, that you just want to whack them harder in some way, that's a human thing. However, this is where we have a job to play, is in the earliest moments where you feel put down by someone, engage with them. Deal with it before. Do preventative medicine. Do it early. You know, if every single one of us were more proactive about dealing with bullshit when it comes up, when we feel put down by someone else, and dealt with it much earlier, we would change a whole lot in the field. And that is that's countercultural work, though. You know, we're supposed to be nice and polite. I'm not saying be unnice and impolite, but... Mm-hmm. Take your time.
Like if you are confronting if somebody's hurting your feelings, so often I go into like a blank spot, and I know, like, my part of me says, come on. But I just sometimes feel like they're too strong.
I get you. That's when we need allies, isn't it? Yeah, when it's an overwhelming force, it's like it's can be pretty impossible to even feel like you can say, "Hey, wait a moment." That's when I would suggest getting an ally of some sort, or getting support to feel more strength internally before addressing that. And it's like, We're so socialized to marginalize those early hurts and think, oh, that's just a little thing, I shouldn't bring it up. I know I am. It's almost like it has to be pretty gross before I'll bark or speak up. And so, but I'm trying to get it earlier so that the affect isn't so strong.
Of revenge and taking the role of the perpetrator unconsciously and not being aware of that power. And it seems to me that oppressed groups historically do that, and it's actually really good because it actually changes the world. It can reset the power balance. I mean, I'm thinking about the way in which sexual abuse survivors, sexism, rape survivors fuel the women's movement to fight for women's equality, or the Stonewall riots, or the labor movement, or the civil rights movement. And so at what point do we want to validate? Because we seem to be kind of saying, hey, it's not so good to just act out revenge from a position of unconscious power. But part of me wants to say, hey, actually a lot of the freedoms that we have now in this room come from oppressed people doing just that and resetting and reclaiming some of the power balance. So.
I think today the difference is, what is the quality? Like, if I'm revengeful and I strike back, I do feel some momentary satisfaction in the impact I've had, and particularly if the other person gets it. But that's just part of the work. It's like, what is the quality of the relationship now? I can be correct and I can strike back and get you for something you've done to me. But if I think in a way, in some way, you're also me, Like I'm striking back at a part of me, and also the other thing is, how am I making deeper connection here? In the moment, I might feel a bit of power, but also it's a disconnected power if I'm not threading new, if I'm not creating new threads to build this relationship. Because it's like I'm looking for those two roles to eventually transform, rather than just people them with fresh personalities and they stay the same. And I'm not at all against, like, you can't marginalize the experience of revenge. It's real. It's human. It's that's all right. It's the level of awareness that we have with that, and the ongoing relationship. Am I creating a sustainable relationship here, or am I just getting back? Because I know for me that when I have revengeful moments and I strike back, you know, initially for a short while I feel pretty good, and then I feel pretty bad, because it's like, what am I doing in a larger arena? I'm not trying to make you feel bad, and I'm not trying to put down all those social political movements, because I was and am part of it. And also, you know, we've probably all been on the receiving end of revenge. So, but it's like the long-term goal for me is creating sustainable relationships. And so today I'm the revenger, tomorrow I'm the revengee. But in both times, I'm actually both roles as well. Or roles, I have both energies. So, yeah, revenge has its part to play, but it needs to be as accountable as any other part in the drama. That's basically all I'm saying. Because, you know, high rank role, being unconscious of their rank or really misusing it, provokes eventual feelings of revenge in the lower rank role, so they strike back and momentarily feel the buzz of putting the other side down and feeling justified. And yet that perpetrates some of the same intractable conflicts through, it perpetrates history. So it's like, yes to revenge in the moment, and then yes to relationship beyond revenge.
That's helpful, yeah. So I was hearing sometimes of no to revenge, or stop the cycle right here, no, yeah, that's...
No, in my developing view, I don't want to say no to any human emotion. It's an energy. I can feel murderous, but that doesn't mean to say I'm going to commit murder. But it's the energy of it. And we get frightened of what we think that energy is going to mean. So we don't say, I feel murderous towards you right now. But not saying it. If I feel murderous, excuse me, Kalpana is my friend, so I'm taking a liberty here. But if I say to Kalpana, I feel murderous towards her, towards you, I'm inhabiting the relationship channel. If I feel murderous towards her and I don't say anything, bet you $5 she's going to feel it. If I said that to her, she'd say, go home and get some food and go to bed, Amici. Are you trying to give me a hint? Right. This looks like close to closing time. Is there anyone who hasn't asked a question who might be a little shy, who'd like to ask a question, or this would be the moment.
I wanted to ask you another question about...
Sure.
A couple of times you mentioned when you're talking to someone or they're talking about their trauma and they're in the place of process where it's important to them, or at least what's happening is that they're giving you the story of how they've been victimized maybe by their trauma. But you said at one point that you are happy to listen to that, but you tried to underline places where, you know, they're basically telling you the story of how they've been, of where they were powerless, but you want to underline that that's not the full dimensionality.
Mm-hmm.
You want to kind of reflect that back to them. I was wondering, I was thinking about a conversation I had with a friend today, actually. And I was, you know, struggling to do that. And so I was wondering how you do that, because it is a very fragile thing. You don't want to overdo it, and you don't want to come from the place of trying to like enforce your own view on them, you know.
Right. I try to ask questions. Wow. So what do you think got you through that? I mean, as simple and open-ended question as I can, I'll say, man, that's a whole lot of shit come down on you. How come you're still standing here?
Okay, thank you.
I think I would have died if that had happened to me. How come you didn't? Without overdoing it. Right. Like you say, it's a delicate negotiation. But first of all, you know, be a human being and imagine that their experience, with a slight shift, another little breeze of the wind of fate, could be yours. So in that way, we're not that much different. There may be degrees of difference, but, you know, bad things can happen to any person without any reason sometimes. One of the things I like about process work is having this, the different layers of reality. So that yes, this happened in consensus reality, and in dreamland, my experience is part of a role, which is part of the drama of human nature. So, everything is valuable. Every experience is meant to somehow be used to increase our personal development and our development as a race. And I need to put it into a larger context than that, because if you keep it in a private, small context, then you keep someone like fixed to one identity. It's kind of like a parallel would be, you can't work on sexism in a room with a woman and only on that arena. Sexism is a social problem. It has to be worked on in a group. You can't solve a woman's personal issues of sexism just in a one-to-one private confines of a therapy. You can do some of the work there, but on a larger level, sexism belongs in the world channel as well as all the other channels. It's the same with trauma. We can do a lot of work in these private locations, but as Gabrielle was pointing out earlier, it really belongs in the social context. And to also be mindful of the limits we have in the moment of hearing and receiving certain parcels of information all of that is, it's all negotiated material. That's what makes being a human being a kind of interesting thing. So I want to thank you very much for listening and participating.
Thank you, Michi. Wow. Thank you for all you covered and shared, and thank you everyone for coming and your presence and bringing also your questions and your actual responses in the moment. Made for an incredible evening. Thank you.
Yeah, very, very rich. Thank you very much. Great questions. And also thank you, Katja, for putting this together. It was lovely.
I'm glad it could happen. And I also, I know there are so many people right now in the world who can't be here who were so thankful for you doing this. And so I just know there are, we have a bigger presence than we realize tonight. And I wanted to point out, we do have a donation basket. If you feel moved and can, it will go towards this and other kinds of research symposia being able to happen. And our next one is probably going to be another fireside chat at the end of May. And we don't yet know the topic. But if you all have requests or presentations that you want to make or ideas about what to explore here, please come up and talk to me or email me. So I think that's it. Good night.
Thank you.